Chapter 49 Wren Year 25 Adam 1 used to say, If you can't stop the waves, go sailing. Or else, what can't be mended may still be tended. Or else, without the light, no chance. Without the dark, no dance. Which meant that even bad things did some good because they were a challenge, and you didn't always know what good effects they might have. Not that the gardeners ever did any dancing, as such. So I decided to perform a meditation, which would be one way of dealing with the fact that there was nothing to do inside the sticky zone. If nothing's the problem, work with nothing, Philo the Fog would say. Turn off your mind chatter. Open up your inner eye, your inner ear. See what you can see. Hear what you can hear. Back at the gardener's, what I'd see would be the pigtails of the girl in front of me, and what I'd hear would be the snoring of Philo, because when he was leading meditation, he always went to sleep. I wasn't much more successful now. I could hear the thump-thump of the bass line coming from the snake pit and the humming of the mini-fridge. I could see the lights of the street making blurry patterns through the glass bricks of the window. But none of this was spiritually enlightening, so I stopped doing the meditation and turned on the news. There was another minor epidemic, they were saying, but nothing to get alarmed about. Viruses and bacteria were always mutating, but I knew the corporations could always invent treatments for them, and anyway, whatever this bug was, I didn't have it myself, because I'd been in isolation with a double virus barrier protecting me. I was in the safest place I could be. I switched back to the snake pit. A fight had broken out. It must have been the painballers, the three who'd come in first, and the other one. As I watched, the Corpsey Corpse minders moved in. They got one of the painballers down on the floor, used their tasers on him. The bouncers were fighting now, too. One of them staggered backwards, clutching his eye. Then another one hit the bar. It didn't usually take this long to get things under control. Savona and Crimson Petal were still up on the trapezes trying to carry on, but the pole girls were scurrying off the stage. Then they ran back onto it again. The exits behind must be blocked. Oh no, I thought. Then a bottle flew into the camera and smashed it. I went to another camera, but my hands were shaking, and I'd forgotten the key in, and by the time I turned it on and got it focused, the snake pit was a lot emptier. The lights were still on, and the music was playing, but the room was a shambles. The customers must have all run out. Savona was lying on the bar. I could tell it was her by the sparkly costume, even though it was half torn off. Her head was bent at a strange angle, and there was blood all over her face. Crimson Petal was hanging from the trapeze. One of the ropes was around her neck, and between her legs was the glint of a bottle. Someone must have shoved it up her. Her frills and ruffles were ripped to shreds. She looked like a limp bouquet. Where was Mordis? A dark, flailing bundle tumbled across the screen. A shadow dance, a kinky ballet. There was the bam of a door slammed back, and then something that sounded like hooting, then sirens in the distance, feet running. Then there was shouting in the hallway outside the sticky zone, and the video screen from outside my door lit up, and on it was Mordis, close up, staring in at me with one eye. The other one was closed. His face looked chewed. "Your name," he whispered. Then an arm grabbed him around the throat, pulled his head back. One of the painballers. I could see his hand holding a slice of bottle, red and blue veins. "Open the fucking door, asshole," he said. "Bitch in heat. Time to share." Mordis was howling. What they wanted from him was the door code. The numbers," they were saying. I saw Mordis for one more instant. There was a gurgling, and he was gone. In his place was the painballer, a face full of scars.
"Open up and we'll let your buddy live," he said. "We won't hurt you."
But he was lying, because Mordis was already dead. Then there was more shouting, and then the corpsey men must have tasered him because he howled in his turn and vanished from the screen, and there was a thudding sound like someone kicking a sack. I went to the snake pit camera. More corpsey men in riot gear, a swarm of them. They were pushing and dragging the painballers out the door. One dead one, three still alive. It would be back to painball for them. They should never have been let out. Not ever. Then I realized what would happen. The sticky zone was a fortress. No one could get in without the door code, and nobody but Mordis knew that code. That's what he always said, and hadn't told it. He'd saved my life. But now I was locked inside, with no one to let me out. "Oh, please," I thought. "I don't want to be dead." Chapter 50. I told myself not to panic. Sexmart would send a cleaning crew, and they'd realize I was in there, and they'd get someone to work on the lock. They wouldn't leave me in there to starve and dry up like a mummy. When they reopened Scales, they'd need me. It wouldn't be at all the same without Mordis. Already I missed him. But at least I would have a function. I wasn't only a disposable. I was talent. That's what Mordis always said. So it was just a matter of waiting it out. I took a shower. I felt dirty, as if those painballers really had got in, or as if I had the blood of Mordis all over me. Then I did another meditation, a real one. "Put light around Mordis," I prayed. "Let him go into the universe. May his spirit go in peace." I pictured him flying up out of his demolished body in the form of a small, brown, beady-eyed bird. The next day, two bad things happened. First, I turned on the news. The minor epidemic they'd been talking about earlier wasn't behaving in the usual way, a local outbreak, one they could contain. Now it was an emergency. They showed a map of the world, with the hot spots lighting up in red. Brazil, Taiwan, Saudi Arabia, Bombay, Paris, Berlin. It was like watching the planet being spray-gunned. It was an eruptive plague, they said, and the thing was spreading fast. No, not even spreading, breaking out at the same time in cities far apart, which wasn't the normal pattern. Ordinarily, the corpse would have called for lies and cover-ups, and we'd hear something like the real story only in rumors. So the fact that all this was right out there on the news showed how serious it was. The corpse couldn't keep the lid on. The news jockeys were trying to keep calm. The experts didn't know what the superbug was, but it was a pandemic for sure, and a lot of people were dying fast, just sort of melting. As soon as they said, "No need for panic," in that eerie, calm tone with those glued-on smiles, I could tell it was really serious. The second bad thing was that some guys in biosuits came into the snake pit and stuffed the dead people into body bags and took them out. But they didn't check out the second floor, although I screamed and screamed. I guess they couldn't hear me, because the sticky zone walls were thick and the snake pit music was still going, and it must have drowned me out. That was lucky for me, because if I'd left the sticky zone right then, I'd have caught what everyone else was catching. So it wasn't really a bad thing. But it felt like it at the time. The next day, the news was even worse. The plague was spreading, and there was rioting and looting and killing going on, and the corpsey corpse had just more or less vanished. They must have been dying too. And a few days after that, there wasn't any more news. Now I was really scared, but I told myself that although I couldn't get out, nobody else could get in, and I'd be okay as long as the solar didn't break down. It would keep the water flowing, and the mini-fridge running, and the freezer and the air filters. Air filtering was a plus, because it would soon be smelling very bad out there. And I would take one day at a time and see what came of it. I knew I'd have to be practical, or I'd lose hope and slide into a fallow state and maybe never come out of it. So I opened the mini-fridge and the freezer and counted all the stuff inside, the Jolt bars and energy drinks and snacks and the frozen chicky knobs and the faux fish. If I ate only a third of every meal instead of half and saved the rest instead of tossing it down the chute, I'd have enough for at least 6 weeks. I'd been trying to call Amanda, but she hadn't answered. All I could do was leave text messages. Come to Scales. My hope was that she'd get the texts and realize something was wrong, and then she'd come to Scales and figure out how to unlock the door. I'd kept my cell phone turned on all the time in case she called, but now when I tried to phone or even text, I got no service. Once I did get a short message, I'm okay. But the channels must have been jammed with frantic people trying to reach their families, because I didn't get anything more. Then I guess the calling must have thinned out as people died, and I was able to get through. No picture, just her voice. "Where are you?" I said. And she said, "Nicked a solar car. Ohio." "Don't go into the cities," I said. "Don't let anyone touch you." I wanted to tell her what I'd been learning from the news, but she'd faded out. After that, I couldn't even get a signal. The relay towers must have gone down. You create your own reality, the horoscopes always said, and the gardeners said that too. So I tried to create the reality of Amanda. Now she was in her khaki desert girl outfit. Now she'd stopped to have a drink of water. Now she was digging up a root and eating it. Now she was walking again. She was coming towards me, hour by hour. She wouldn't get the sickness, and no one would kill her because she was so smart and strong. She was smiling. Now she was singing. But I knew I was just making it up. Chapter 51. I hadn't seen Amanda except on the phone for such a long time, not since I'd started working at Scales. Before that, there had been a period when I hadn't even known where she was. I'd lost touch when Lucerne had thrown out my purple phone back when I'd still been living inside the Healthwiser compound. At that time, I thought I'd never see Amanda again, that she was gone out of my life forever. That was what I still believed as I sat on the bullet train on my way to the Martha Graham Academy. I was feeling very alone and sorry for myself. I hadn't lost only Amanda. I'd lost everything in my life that had any meaning. The Adams and the Eves, or some of them, such as Toby and Zeb. Amanda. But most of all, Jimmy. I was over the worst of the hurt he'd caused me. But there was a dull ache. He'd been so sweet to me. Then he'd shut me out as if I wasn't really there. That was a cold and miserable feeling. I was so depressed that I'd even given up the idea that I might get together with Jimmy again at Martha Graham. It seemed like a far-fetched daydream. By the time I was on that bullet train, it had been a long time since I'd been in love with Jimmy. No, it had been a long time since Jimmy had been in love with me. When I was being honest and not only angry and sad, I knew that I was still in love with Jimmy. I'd slept with other boys, but I'd just been going through the motions. I was going to Martha Graham partly to get away from Lucerne, but also, I had to do something, so I might as well get an education. That's how they talked about it, as if an education was a thing that you got, like a dress. I didn't care what happened to me one way or the other. I just felt gray. That was not at all the gardener way of thinking. The gardener said the only real education was the education of the spirit. But I'd forgotten what that meant. Martha Graham was an artistic school named after a famous ancient dancer, so dance courses were featured at it. Since I had to take something, I took dance calisthenics and dramatic expression. You didn't need any background or math for those. I figured I could get a job in one of the corps, leading the in-corp noon-hour exercise programs that the better ones had. Tone to music. Yoga for middle management. One of those. The Martha Graham campus was like the Buena Vista condos. It had been classy once, but now it was falling apart and had mold issues, and the ceilings leaked. I couldn't eat the stuff in the cafeteria, because who knew what was in it? I still had a lot of trouble with animal protein, especially if it might be organs and noses. But I felt more at home there than I had in the Healthwiser compound, because at least Martha Graham wasn't so shiny and fake-looking, and it didn't smell of chemical cleaning products, or any cleaning products at all. Every fresh person at Martha Graham had to share a suite. The roommate I was given was called Buddy the Third. I didn't see much of him. He was in football, but the Martha Graham team always got pulverized, and Buddy the Third was drunk or stoned a lot as a result. I'd lock the door on my side of our shared bathroom because the guys on the football team were known for date rape, and I didn't think Buddy would even bother with the date part of it. But I could hear him in there throwing up in the mornings. There was a Happy Cuppa franchise on campus, and I'd go there for breakfast because they had vegan muffins. I wouldn't have to listen to Buddy puking, and I could use their washroom, which stank less than mine. One day I was walking up to the Happy Cuppa, and there was Bernice. I recognized her right away. I was really startled to see her. It was shocking. Like a jolt of electricity. All the guilt I'd once felt about her, but had more or less forgotten, came flooding back. She was wearing a green T-shirt with a big G on it and holding a sign that said, "A happy cuppa is a crappy cuppa." There were two other kids with the same T-shirt, but different signs. "Brew of evil. Don't drink death." I could see from the outfits and facial expressions that they were extreme fanatic ultra greens and they were picketing the place. This was the year when there were all the Happy Cuppa riots. I'd seen them on screen. Bernice wasn't any prettier than she used to be. If anything, she was chunkier, and her scowling was fiercer. She didn't spot me, so I had a choice. I could have gone right past her and into the Happy Cuppa, pretending I hadn't seen her, or I could have turned around and slid away. But I found myself going right back into gardener mode, remembering all those teachings about taking responsibility and if you killed a thing, you had to eat it. And I had killed Bert, in a way. Or I felt I had. So I didn't dodge it. Instead, I went right up to her and said, "Bernice, it's me, Wren." She jumped as if I'd kicked her. Then she focused on me. "So I see," she said in a sour voice. "Let me buy you a coffee," I said. I must have been really nervous to say that because why would Bernice want a coffee from a place she was picketing? She must have thought I was making fun of her because she said, "Piss off." "Sorry," I said. "I didn't mean it that way. How about a water then? We could drink it over there by the statue." The statue of Martha Graham was a sort of mascot. It showed her being Judith, holding up the head of her enemy, Holofernes, and the students had painted the head's neck stump red and stuck steel wool under Martha's armpits. There was a flat base right underneath the Holofernes head where you could sit. She gave me another scowl. "You are so backslidden," she said. "Bottled water is evil. Don't you know anything?" I could have called her a bitch and just walked away from everything, but this was my one chance to put things right, at least with myself. "Bernice," I said, "I want to make you an apology, so just tell me what you can drink, and I'll get some of it and we'll go someplace and drink it." She was still grumpy. No one could hold a grudge like her. But after I'd said we needed to put light around it, which must have triggered off the better gardener part of her,
She said there was this organic mix in a recyclable carton made of pressed kudzu leaves. You could get it at the campus supermarket, and she still had some picketing to do, but by the time I came back with the stuff, she could take a break. We sat underneath the head of Holofernes, with the two boxes of liquid mulch I'd bought, and the taste brought back my early days at the gardener's. How unhappy I'd been at first, and how Bernice had stuck up for me then. "Didn't you go to the West Coast?" I asked her. "After all that..." "Yeah," she said. "Well, I'm back here now." She said that Vina had backslidden and joined an entirely different religion called the Known Fruits, who claimed it was a mark of God's favor to be rich because by their fruits ye shall know them, and fruits meant bank accounts. Vina had gone into a Healthwiser vitamin supplements franchise and had quickly expanded to 5 outlets and was doing very well. Bernice said the West Coast was perfect for that, because although they all did stuff like yoga and said it was spiritual, they were really just twisted, fish-crunching, materialistic body worshippers out there with facelifts and bimplants and gene work and totally warped values. Vina had wanted Bernice to take business at college, but Bernice had stayed a gardener by faith, so they'd fought about it, and Martha Graham was a compromise because it had courses in how to profit from holistic healing, which was what Bernice was taking. I couldn't picture Bernice healing anything because I couldn't picture her wanting to heal anything. Grinding dirt into your cut was more her style. But I said that was really interesting. I told her what I was taking, but I saw she didn't care. So I told her about my roommate, Buddy the Third, and she said the entire Martha Graham Academy was filled with people like that. Ex-fernals, frittering away their time on Earth without one serious thought in their heads except drinking and getting laid. She'd had a roommate like that at first, plus he'd been an animal murderer because he'd worn leather sandals. Though they'd been pleather, but they'd looked like leather, so she'd burnt them. And thank God she didn't have to share a bathroom with him anymore, because she could hear him doing sexual things with girls practically every night, like some degenerate bonobo rabbit splice. "Jimmy," she said, "what a meat breath." When I heard the name Jimmy, I thought, it can't be the same one. But then I thought, oh yes, it can. While this was running through my head, Bernice said why didn't I move into the room adjoining hers, since now that Jimmy had moved out, it was empty. I'd wanted to make it up with her, but not that much, so I launched into what I needed to say. "I'm very sorry about Bert," I said. "Your dad, about him dying like that. I feel so responsible." She looked at me as if I was crazy. "What are you talking about?" she said. "That time I told you he was having sex with Nuala, and you told Vina and she blew up and called the Corpsey Corpse? Well, I don't think he was having sex with Nuala. Me and Amanda, we kind of made it up because we were being mean. I feel terrible about it, and I'm really sorry. I don't think he ever did anything worse than girls' armpits." "At least Nuala was a grown-up," said Bernice. "But he didn't stop at the armpits, with the girls. He was a degenerate, just like my mother said. He used to tell me I was his favorite little girl, but not even that was true. So I told Vina. That's why she ratted him out. So you can stop feeling so self-important." I got the old glare, though this time with red, watery eyes. "You're just lucky it was never you." "Oh," I said. "Bernice, I'm really sorry." "I don't want to talk about this anymore," said Bernice. "I prefer to spend my time in more productive ways." She said, would I come and stencil Happy Cup of protest signs with her? And I said I'd already skipped one class that day, but maybe some other time. She gave me that slitty-eyed look that said she could tell I was wriggling out of something. Then I asked her what her old roommate Jimmy had actually looked like, and she said, why was that any of my business?
She was right back into her bossy mode, and I knew that if I hung around with her much longer, I'd be 9 years old again, and she'd have the same hold on me, only more so because however awful things might be for me in my life, they'd always be worse in hers, and she'd have a victim hammerlock on me. I said I really had to run, and she said, "Yeah, right." And then she said I hadn't changed at all. I was still just as much of a simpy lightweight as I'd ever been. Years later, when I was already working at Scales and Tails, I saw on screen that Bernice had been spray-gunned in a raid on a gardener's safe house. That was after the gardeners had been outlawed, though being outlawed wouldn't have stopped Bernice. She was a person with the courage of her convictions. I had to admire her for that, for the convictions, and also for the courage, because I never really felt I had either one. There was a close-up of her dead face, looking more gentle and peaceful than I'd ever seen her look in life. Maybe that was the real Bernice, I thought, kind and innocent. Maybe she was truly like that inside, and all the fighting we used to do, and all her sharp and unpleasant edges. That was her way of struggling to get out of the hard skin she'd grown all over herself like a beetle shell. But no matter how she hid out and raged, she'd been stuck in there. That thought made me feel so sorry for her that I cried. Chapter 52. Before that conversation with Bernice, when she talked about her former roommate, I'd been half expecting to see Jimmy in a classroom, at the Happy Cuppa, or just walking somewhere. But now I felt he must be very close by. He was right around the corner, or on the other side of a window, or I'd wake up one morning and there he would be, right beside me, holding my hand and looking at me the way he used to do when we first got together. It was like being haunted. Maybe I've imprinted on Jimmy, I thought. Like a baby duck hatching out of an egg, and the first thing it sees is a weasel, so that's what it follows around for the rest of its life. Which is likely to be short. Why did it have to be Jimmy who was the first person I'd fallen in love with? Why couldn't it have been someone with a better character, or at least a less fickle person, a more serious person, not so given to playing the fool? The worst thing about it was that I couldn't get interested in anyone else. There was a hole in my heart that only Jimmy could fill. I know that's a country and western thing to say. I'd heard enough of that kind of worldly music on my See Here Candy by then. But it's the only way I can explain it. And it isn't that I wasn't aware of Jimmy's faults, because I was. I did see Jimmy eventually, of course. The campus wasn't huge, so it was bound to happen sooner or later. I saw him in the distance, and he saw me. But he didn't come rushing over. He stayed in the distance. He didn't even wave. He looked away as if he hadn't seen me. So if I'd been waiting for the answer to the question I was always asking myself, does Jimmy still love me? I had it now. Then I met a girl in dance calisthenics, Shayluba somebody, who'd been with Jimmy for a while. She said it was great at first, but he started saying how he was really bad for her. He was incapable of commitment because of the girlfriend he'd had in high school. They were too young, it ended badly, and he'd been an emotional dumpster ever since. But maybe he was destructive by nature since he messed up every girl he touched. "Was her name Wakula Price?" I asked. "No, actually," said Shayluba. "It was you. He pointed you out." "Jimmy, what a fraud and bullshitting liar you are," I thought. But then I thought, what if it's true? What if I'd crapped up Jimmy's life just as much as he'd crapped up mine? I tried to forget all about him, but somehow I couldn't. Beating myself up over Jimmy had become a bad habit with me, like biting your nails. Every once in a while I'd see him drifting past in the distance, which was like having just one cigarette when you're trying to quit.
it starts you off again. Not that I was ever a smoker. I'd been at Martha Graham for almost 2 years when I got some really terrible news. Lucerne called me and said that my biofather Frank had been kidnapped by a rival corpse somewhere to the east of Europe. The corpse over there were always trying to poach on our corpse. Their undercover thugs were even more cutthroat than ours, and they had an advantage because they were better at languages and could pretend to be immigrants. We couldn't do that to them, because why would we immigrate there? They'd bagged Frank right inside the compound, in the men's room of his lab building, said Lucerne, and shipped him out in a Zizzy Fruits delivery van. Then they'd carted him across the Atlantic Ocean in an airship, wrapped up in gauze bandages and disguised as a patient recovering from a facelift. Worse, they'd sent back a DVD of him in a drugged-looking state, confessing that Healthwiser had been sticking a slow-acting but incurable gene-spliced disease germ inside their supplements so they could make a lot of money on the treatments. It was blackmail, pure and simple, said Lucerne. They'd trade Frank for a couple of the formulas they wanted, most notably the ones for the slow-acting diseases, and, in addition, they wouldn't make the incriminating DVD public. But otherwise, they'd said, Frank's head would have to kiss his body goodbye. Healthwiser had done a cost-benefit analysis, said Lucerne, and they decided the disease germs and formulas were worth more to them than Frank was. As for the adverse publicity, they could squelch it at source, since the media corps controlled what was news and what wasn't. And the internet was such a jumble of false and true factoids that no one believed what was on it anymore, or else they believed all of it, which amounted to the same thing. So Healthwiser wasn't going to pay up. They said they regretted Lucerne's loss, but it wasn't their policy to give in to blackmail demands, as that would encourage more kidnappings, which were numerous enough as it was. Therefore, Lucerne had lost her top wife position at Healthwiser, and the house along with it. And under the circumstances, which were unfortunate, she decided to move to the Cryogenius compound and take up housekeeping with a very nice man she'd met through the golf club, whose name was Todd. And she certainly hoped I wouldn't go overboard with grief about Frank, the way I went overboard on all my other emotions. Cryogenius. What a scam that place was. You paid to get your head frozen when you died, in case someone in the future invented a way to regrow a body onto your neck. Though the kids at Healthwiser used to joke that they didn't freeze anything but head shells because they'd already scooped out the neurons and transplanted them into pigs. They made a lot of gruesome jokes like that at Healthwiser High, though you never knew whether they were actually jokes. The upshot was, Lucerne continued, that money was tight. Todd wasn't a senior vice president. He was only an accounts manager, and he had 3 young children of his own to support who would have to take priority over me, and she could hardly ask Todd to pay for me in addition to everything else he was paying for. So I would have to stop coasting along at college and leave Martha Graham and take responsibility for myself. I was out of the nest in one swift kick. Not that I was ever in much of a nest. I'd always been on the edge of the ledge with Lucerne. This is irony, I thought. I'd learned about irony in dance theatrics. There was Lucerne, who told a slanderous whopper about being kidnapped, and now poor Frank, my biofather, really had been kidnapped and probably murdered as well. It was clear that Lucerne didn't feel much of anything about that. As for me, I didn't know what to feel. Before the spring term exams, the various corps set up interview booths in the main hallway. Not the serious corps, the science ones. They wouldn't bother recruiting at Martha Graham. They wanted numbers people. But the more frivolous ones. I wasn't eligible for these interviews because I wasn't graduating that year. But I decided to go anyway and take a chance. I wouldn't get any of the jobs on offer, but maybe they'd take me on as a floor scrubber. I'd done some floor scrubbing at the gardener's, though naturally I couldn't say that or I'd get stamped as a fanatical greeny weirdo. My dance calisthenics teacher said I should talk to Scales and Tails. I was a good enough dancer, and Scales was part of SexMart now, which was a legitimate corp with health benefits and a dental plan, so it wasn't like being a prostitute. A lot of girls went into it, and some of them met nice men that way and did very well in life afterwards. So I thought I might try for it. I wasn't likely to get anything better without a degree. Even a Martha Graham degree was a lot better than none, and I didn't want to end up as a meat barista at some place like Secret Burgers. That day I managed to line up 5 interviews. I had butterflies in my stomach, but I sucked it up and smiled and talked my way in, even though I wasn't on the graduating list. I could have done 6. Cryogenius was looking for a comfort girl to soothe the relatives who were getting the heads of their loved ones and sometimes their dead pets frozen. But I couldn't work there because of Lucerne. I didn't ever want to see her again, not only because of what she'd done to me, but also because of how she'd done it, like firing the maid. I saw the hiring teams from Happy Cuppa and Chicky Knobs and Zizzy Fruits and Scales and Tails, and finally a new you. The first 3 didn't want me, but I did get an offer from Scales and Tails. Each corp had a team doing the interviewing, and Mortis was part of the Scales team. There were some SexMart higher-ups there, too, but he was the man on the ground, so it was really his call. I did a routine from Dance Calisthenics, and Mortis said I was exactly what he was looking for, such talent, and if I came to Scales, he'd make sure I wouldn't regret it. "You can be whoever you want," he said. "Act it out." So I almost signed up. But the Anu Yu booth was right next to Scales, and on that team there was a woman who reminded me a lot of Toby at the Gardeners. Though she was darker and had different hair, her eyes were green and her voice was huskier. She took me a little aside and asked me if I was in trouble, and I found myself explaining that for family reasons I had to leave college. "I'd do any kind of a job," I said. "I was willing to learn." When she asked me what family reasons, I blurted out about my father being kidnapped and my mother not having any money. I could hear my voice going trembly. It wasn't all acting. Then she asked me what my mother's name was. I told her, and she nodded. She'd take me on at the Anu Yu Spa as an apprentice, and I could live right on the premises, and they'd train me. I'd be working with women, not with men who'd be drunk and violent as they often were at Scales, even if it did have a dental plan. And I wouldn't have to wear a biofilm bodysuit and let strange men touch me. It would be a healing atmosphere, and I'd be helping people. This woman really did look like Toby, and strangely enough, the name on her tag was Tobiatha. That was like a sign to me that I'd be really safe there and welcomed, and also wanted. So I said yes. Mortis gave me his card anyway and said that if I changed my mind, he'd take me on at Scales any time, no questions asked. Chapter 53. The Anu Yu Spa was located in the middle of the Heritage Park. I'd heard a lot about it because Adam One had been so against it. He'd said that many creatures and also trees had been destroyed to build a pavilion to vanity. Sometimes on pollination day, he'd preach a whole sermon about it. But in spite of that, I felt happy there. They had roses that glowed in the dark, and big pink butterflies in the daytime, and beautiful kudzu moths at night, and a swimming pool, although staff couldn't use it, and fountains, and their own organic vegetable garden. The air was better there than it was in the middle of the city, so you didn't have to wear nose cones so much. It was like a comforting dream. They put me to work in the laundry room folding the sheets and towels, and I liked that because it was peaceful. Everything was pink. On my 3rd day there, Tobiatha came across me as I was carrying a stack of clean towels to one of the rooms and said she'd like to talk to me. I thought maybe I'd done something wrong. We walked out onto the lawn, and she told me to keep my voice down. Then she said that she could tell I'd partly recognized her, and she had certainly recognized me. She'd hired me because I'd been a gardener, and now that they'd been outlawed and the garden destroyed, we had a duty to look after one another. She could see I was in trouble, beyond not having any money. What was the matter? I started to cry because I hadn't known about the garden. It was a shock. I must have had it in my mind that I could go back there if things got really bad. She took me to sit down beside one of the fountains, so the rushing water would blot out our voices in case there were any directional microphones, she said. And I told her about Healthwiser, and how I'd been in touch with the gardeners through Amanda before I'd lost my cell, and I didn't know anything about the garden after that. I didn't say anything about being in love with Jimmy and how he'd broken my heart. But I did tell about Martha Graham and about Lucerne cutting me off in that abrupt way after my father had been kidnapped. Then I said I had no direction in life, and I felt numb inside, like an orphan. She said all of that must be very disturbing. She'd had a difficult time, too, when she'd been my age, and something similar had happened to her about her father. This new version of Toby wasn't nearly as hard-ass as she'd been when she was Eve 6. She was mellower. Or maybe I was older. She looked around and lowered her voice. Then she told me she'd had to leave the Eden Cliff rooftop garden in a hurry and get some alterations done on herself because she'd been in danger there. So I'd have to be very careful not to tell anyone who she was. She'd taken a risk with me, and she hoped she could trust me, and I said she could. Then she warned me that Lucerne came to the spa sometimes, and I should be aware of that and try to keep out of her sightline. Finally, she said that if anything should happen, some crisis, and she wasn't around, I should know that she'd put together a dried foods gardener-style Ararat right in the Anuyu spa supply room. She told me the door code in case I might ever need to get in, though she hoped it would never be necessary. I thanked her very much, and then I asked if she knew where Amanda was. I'd really like to see her again, I said. She was about my only real friend. Toby said she might be able to find out. We didn't talk often after that. Toby said it would look suspicious, even though she didn't know who might be watching. But we'd exchange a few words and nods. I felt she was guarding me, protecting me with some space alien type of force field, though of course I was only making that up. One day, after I'd been there for nearly a year, Toby said she'd located Amanda through mutual acquaintances on the internet. What she told me was surprising, though not too surprising when I thought about it. Amanda had become a bio-artist. She did art involving creatures or parts of creatures arranged outdoors on a giant scale. She was living near the western entrance of the Heritage Park, and if I wanted to see her, Toby could arrange a pass for me and get me driven there in one of the pink Anuyu minivans. I threw my arms around Toby and hugged her, but she said I should watch that, a laundry room girl hugging the manager. Then she said I shouldn't get too involved with Amanda. Amanda had a tendency to go too far. She didn't know the limits of her own strength. I wanted to ask her what she meant, but she was walking away. On the day of the visit, Toby told me that Amanda had been alerted that I was coming, but the two of us should wait until I was inside the door before hugging or shrieking or other demonstrations. She gave me a basket of Anuyu products to deliver as an excuse in case anyone stopped the van and asked where I was going. The driver would wait for me. I would have only an hour, because it would look odd for an Anuyu girl to be wandering around in the external too long. I said maybe I should go in disguise, and she said no, because the guards would ask questions.
so I had to put on my pink Anuyu top to toe over my work smock and cotton pants and go off with my pink basket, like Little Pink Riding Hood. I got delivered to Amanda's falling-apart condo by the Anuyu minivan, as planned. I did remember what Toby had said. I waited until I was inside the door, where Amanda was waiting, and then we both said, "I can't believe it," and held on to each other. But not for long. Amanda had never been much of a hugger. She was taller than when I'd last seen her in the flesh. She'd got a tan, even through the sunblock and hats, from doing so much outdoors art, she said. We went into her kitchen, which had a lot of her designs pinned up on the walls, and some bones here and there, and we had a beer each. I've never liked drinking alcohol that much, but this was special. We started talking about the gardeners, Adam One, and Nuala, and Moogie the Mussel, and Philo the Fog, and Katuro, and Rebecca, and Zeb, and Toby, though I didn't say she was now Tobiatha and managing the Anuyu Spa. Amanda told me why Toby had to leave the gardeners. It was because Blanco from the sewage lagoon was after her. Blanco had the street rep of snuffing anyone who'd annoyed him, especially women. "Why her?" I said. Amanda said she'd heard it was some old sexual thing, which was puzzling, she said, because sexual things and Toby had never fitted together, which was most likely why we kids had called her the dry witch. And I said maybe Toby had been wetter than we'd thought, and Amanda laughed and said, obviously I still believed in miracles. But now I knew why Toby was hiding out with a different identity. "Remember how we used to say, 'Knock, knock, who's there?' You and me and Bernice," I said. The beer was creeping up on me. "Gang," said Amanda. "Gang who?" "Gang green," I said, and we both snorted with laughter, and some of the beer went up my nose. Then I told her about running into Bernice and how she'd been as crabby as ever. We laughed about that, too, but we didn't mention dead Bert. I said, "What about the time you arranged that superweed treat for me with Shacky and Croge, and we all went into the Holospinner booth and I threw up?" So we laughed some more. She told me she had two roommates who were artists as well, and also, for the first time in her life, she had a live-in boyfriend. I asked if she was in love with him, and she said, "I'll try anything once." I asked what he was like, and she said really sweet, though moody at times because he was still getting over some teen lust girlfriend. And I said, "What was his name?" And she said, "Jimmy. Maybe you knew him at Healthweiser High. He must have been there about the same time you were." I got a very cold feeling. She said, "That's him on the fridge, two pictures down on the right." It was Jimmy, all right, with his arm around Amanda, grinning like an electrocuted frog. I felt as if she'd stuck a nail right into my heart. But there was no point in spoiling things for Amanda by telling her that. She hadn't done it on purpose. I said, "He looks really cute. And now I have to go because it's time for the driver." She asked if there was anything wrong, and I said no. She gave me her cell phone number and said next time I came to visit, she'd make sure Jimmy was there and we'd all have spaghetti. It would be nice to believe that love should be dished out in a fair way so that everyone got some. But that wasn't how it was going to be for me. I went back to the Anuyu Spa, feeling totally dumped out and hollow. Then, just after I got back, when I was carting the towels around to the rooms, I almost ran right into Lucerne. It was her time to have her face lifted again. Toby had warned me about it each time she came so I could lower my profile and evade her, but because of Amanda and Jimmy, it had gone right out of my head. I smiled at her in the neutral way we'd been trained. I think she recognized me, but she blew me off like I was a piece of lint. Although I hadn't ever wanted to see her or talk to her, it was a very bad feeling
to know that she didn't want to see me or talk to me either. It was like being erased off the slate of the universe, to have your own mother act as if you'd never been born. At that moment, I understood that I couldn't stay at a new you. I needed to be on my own, apart from Amanda, apart from Jimmy, apart from Lucerne, even apart from Toby. I wanted to be someone else entirely. I didn't want to owe anyone anything or be owed anything either. I wanted no strings, no past, and no questions asked. I was tired of asking questions. I found the card Mortis had given me and left a note for Toby, thanking her for everything and saying that for personal reasons I couldn't work at the spa any longer. I still had the day pass I'd used for Amanda, so I left right then. Everything was ruined and destroyed, and there was no safe place for me, and if I had to be in an unsafe place, it might as well be an unsafe place where I was appreciated. When I got to Scales, I had to talk my way past the bouncers because they didn't believe I was really looking for a job there. But finally they called Mortis, and he said, oh yes, he remembered me. I was the little dancer. Brenda, wasn't it? I said yes, but he could call me Wren. I already felt that comfortable with him. He asked me if I was really serious about the job, and I said I was, and he said there was a minimum undertaking because they didn't want to waste the training, so would I be willing to sign a contract? I said maybe I was too sad for the job. Didn't they want a more upbeat personality in their girls? But Mortis smiled with his shiny black ant eyes and said, as if he was patting me, Wren, Wren, everyone's too sad for everything. Chapter 54. So I did go to work at Scales after all. In some ways it was a relief. I liked having Mortis for a boss, because at least it was clear what pleased him. He made me feel safe, maybe because he was the closest thing to a father I was ever going to get. Zeb had vanished into thin air, and my real father hadn't found me very interesting, and, in addition, he was dead. But Mortis said I was really something special. I was the answer to every dream, wet ones included. It was so encouraging to be doing something I was good at. I didn't like the other parts of the job that much, but I did like the trapeze dancing, because nobody could touch you then. You were up in the air, like a butterfly. I used to picture Jimmy looking at me and thinking it was really me he'd loved all along, not Wakula Price or Linda Lee or any of the others, or even Amanda, and that I was dancing just for him. I do know how useless this was. After going to Scales, I was only in touch with Amanda by phone. She was away a lot doing her art projects. Also, I didn't want to see her in person. I'd feel uncomfortable because of Jimmy, and she'd pick up on that feeling and ask about it. And I'd either lie or tell her, and if I told her she'd be angry, or maybe just curious, or she'd think I was being stupid. There was a hard side to Amanda. Jealousy is a very destructive emotion, Adam One used to say. It's part of the stubborn Australopithecine heritage we're stuck with. It eats away at you and deadens your spiritual life. But also, it leads you to hatred and causes you to harm others. But Amanda was the last person I'd ever want to harm. I tried to visualize my jealousy as a yellowy-brown cloud boiling around inside me, then going out through my nose like smoke and turning into a stone and falling down into the ground. That did work a little. But in my visualization, a plant covered with poison berries would grow out of the stone, whether I wanted it to or not. Then Amanda broke up with Jimmy. She let me know about it in a roundabout way. She'd already told me about her outdoor art landscape installation series called The Living Word, how she was spelling words out in giant letters,
using bioforms to make the words appear and then disappear, just like the words she used to do with ants and syrup when we were kids. Now, she said, I'm up to the four-letter words. And I said, you mean the dirty ones, like shit? And she laughed and said, worse ones than that. And I said, you mean the C word and the F word? And she said, no, like love. And I said, oh, so Jimmy didn't work out. And she said, Jimmy can't be serious. So I knew he must have cheated on her or something like that. I'm sorry, I said. Are you really pissed off at him? I tried to keep the happiness out of my own voice. Now I can forgive her, I thought. But really there was nothing to forgive her for because she hadn't done anything hurtful to me on purpose. Pissed off, she said. You can't be pissed off with Jimmy. I wondered what she meant by that, because I was certainly pissed off with Jimmy, though I still loved him. Maybe that's what love is, I thought. It's being pissed off. After a while, Glenn started coming to Scales. Not every night, but often enough to get discounts. I hadn't seen him since Healthwiser. He'd been with the Brainiacs doing science at the Watson Crick Institute, but now he was a top guy at the Rejuve Corp. He wasn't shy about bragging, though with Glenn, it was more like stating a fact, the way you'd say, it's going to rain. What I picked up from listening in on his conversations with the Mr. Biggs and his funders was that he was in charge of a really important initiative called the Paradise Project. They'd built a special dome for it, with its own air supply and quadruple security. He'd assembled a team of the best brains available, and they were working night and day. Glenn was vague about what they were working on. Immortality was a word he used. Rejuve had been interested in it for decades, something about changing your cells so they'd never die. People would pay a lot for immortality, he said. Every couple of months, he'd claim they'd made a breakthrough, and the more breakthroughs he made, the more money he could raise for the Paradise Project. Sometimes he'd say he was working on solutions to the biggest problem of all, which was human beings, their cruelty and suffering, their wars and poverty, their fear of death. What would you pay for the design of a perfect human being? He'd say. Then he'd hint that the Paradise Project was designing one, and they'd dump more money on him. For the finales of these meetings, he'd rent the feather ceiling room and order up the drinks and the drugs and the scalies, not for himself, but for the guys he'd bring with him. Sometimes he'd even entertain the top corpsey men. They were sinister, those guys. I never had to do the painballers, but I had to do the corpsey men, and they were my least favorite clients. It was like they had machine parts in behind their eyes. Occasionally, Glenn would rent two or three scalies for the whole evening. Not for sex, but for some very strange things. Once he wanted us to purr like cats so he could measure our vocal cords. Another time, he wanted us to sing like birds so he could record us. Starlight complained to Mortis that this wasn't what we were paid for. But Mortis only said, "So he's a loony. You've seen those before. But he's a rich loony, and he's harmless, so just humor him." I was part of the threesome the night he gave us a sort of quiz. What would make us happy, he wanted to know. Was happiness more like excitement or more like contentment? Was happiness inside or outside? With trees or without? Did it have running water nearby? Did too much of it get boring? Starlight and Crimson Petal tried to figure out what he wanted to hear so they could tell the right lies. No, I said. I knew what Glenn was like. He's a geek. He wants us to say what we honestly feel. Which confused them a lot. He never asked us about sadness, though. Maybe he thought he knew enough about that. Then he started bringing a woman, an Asian fusion body type, with a foreign accent. He said she wanted to familiarize herself with scales because Rejuve had picked us as one of their prime test venues, and she'd be explaining a new product to us, the Bliss Plus pill, which would solve every known problem connected with sex. We had been awarded the privilege of introducing it to our clients. This woman had a Rejuve executive title, Senior VP Satisfaction Enhancement, though her real job was Glenn's main plank. I could tell she'd been one of us, a girl for rent, of one kind or another. It was obvious if you knew the signs. She was acting all the time, giving nothing away about herself. I'd watched them on screen. I was curious because Glenn was such a cold fish. But he could have sex all right, just like a human being. This girl had more moves than an octopus, and her plank work was astonishing. Glenn acted like she was the first, last, and only girl on the planet. Mortis used to watch them too, and he said scales would pay this girl top dollar. But I told him he couldn't afford her. She was way out of his price range. The two of them had pet names for each other. She'd call him Crake. He'd call her Oryx. The other girls found it strange, the two of them being lovey-dovey, because it was so out of character for Glenn. But I thought it was kind of nice. "That Russian or something?" Crimson Petal asked me. "Oryx and Crake?" "I guess," I said. They were extinct animal names. Every gardener had to memorize a ton of those. But if I said it, the girls would wonder why I knew. The first time Glenn came to Scales, I recognized him right away, but of course he didn't recognize me in my biofilm bodysuit and with green sequins all over my face, and I didn't let on. Mortis told us not to forge personal bonds with the customers, because if they wanted a relationship, they could get one elsewhere. He said that Scales customers didn't care about your life history. They just wanted epidermis and fantasy. They wanted to be carried away to Never Never Land, where they could have sinful experiences they'd never, never be able to have at home. Dragon ladies winding around them, snake women slithering over them. So we should save our private emotional crap for people who actually cared about us, like the other Scalies. One night, Glenn arranged an evening of extra special treatment for an extra special guest, he said. He ordered up the feather room with the green bedspread, plus the most powerful Scales and Tails martinis, kicktails they called them, plus two Scalies, me and Crimson Petal. Mortis picked us because Glenn said this extra special guest preferred the slender body type. "Does he want the schoolgirl sailor suit thing?" I asked. Sometimes that's what slender body type meant. "Do I need to bring my skipping rope?" If so, I'd have to change because right then I was in full glitter.
"This guy's already so shit-faced he doesn't know what he wants," Mortis said. "Just give him your all, baby bunny. We want to see the high number tips. Make those multiple zeros shoot right out of his ears."
When we got to the room, the guy was lying on the green satin bedspread as if he'd been thrown from a plane, but happy about it, because he had a whole body grin. It was Jimmy. Sweet, ruinous Jimmy. Jimmy who'd trashed my life. My heart flipped over. "Oh shit," I thought. "I'm not up to this. I'm going to lose it and start crying." I knew he wouldn't know it was me. I was covered in glitz, and he was flying so high he was almost blind. So I just slid into the usual act and started in on his buttons and Velcro. We Scalies used to call it peeling the shrimp. "Oh, nice abs," I whispered. "Honey, just lie back." Did I hate this or love it? Why did it have to be one or the other?
as Vilya always said about her boobs. Take two. They're cheap. Now he was trying to pull the scales off my face, so I had to keep taking his hands and putting them elsewhere.
Are you a fish?
He was saying. He didn't seem to know. Oh, Jimmy, I thought. What's left of you?
St. Diane, Martyr. Year 24. Of Persecution, spoken by Adam 1.
Dear friends, dear faithful companions, our Eden Cliff rooftop garden blooms now only in our memories. On this earthly plane, it is now a desolation, a swamp or a desert, depending on rainfall. How changed is our situation from our former green and salad days? How shrunk, how dwindled are our numbers? We are driven from one refuge to another. We are hounded and pursued. Some former friends have renounced our creeds. Others have borne false witness against us. Yet others have tried extremism and violence and have been murderously spray-gunned in the course of raids carried out against them. We remember in this connection our dear former child, Bernice. Let us put light around her. Some have been mutilated and tossed into vacant lots to sow panic among us. Yet others have disappeared, snatched from their places of refuge, to vanish into the prisons of the external powers, denied trial, forbidden even to know the names of their accusers. Their minds may already have been destroyed by drugs and torture, their bodies melted into garboil. Because of unjust laws, we cannot learn the whereabouts of these, our fellow gardeners. We can only hope that they will die in unwavering faith. Today is St. Diane's Day, consecrated to interspecies empathy. On this day, we invoke St. Jerome of Lyons and St. Robert Burns of Mice and St. Christopher Smart of Cats, also St. Farley Moat of Wolves, and the Ikhwan al-Safa and their Letter of the Animals. But especially St. Diane Fossey, who gave her life while defending the gorillas from ruthless exploitation. She labored for a peaceable kingdom in which all life would be respected. Yet malignant forces combined to destroy both her and her gentle primate companions. Her murder was horrific, and equally horrific were the malicious rumors spread about her, both during her lifetime and after it. For the external powers kill both in deed and in word. St. Diane embodies an ideal we hold dear, loving care for all other creatures. She believed that these deserve the same tenderness we would show to beloved friends and kinfolk, and in this she is a revered model for us. She is buried among her gorilla friends on the mountain she tried to protect. Like many martyrs, St. Diane did not live to see the fulfillment of her labors. At least she has been spared the knowledge that the species for which she gave her life is no more. Like so many others, it has been wiped from the face of God's planet. What is it about our own species that leaves us so vulnerable to the impulse to violence? Why are we so addicted to the shedding of blood? Whenever we are tempted to become puffed up and to see ourselves as superior to all other animals, we should reflect on our own brutal history. Take comfort in the thought that this history will soon be swept away by the waterless flood. Nothing will remain of the external world but decaying wood and rusting metal implements. And over these, the kudzu and other vines will climb, and birds and animals will nest in them, as we are told in the human words of God. They shall be left together unto the fowls of the mountains, and to the beasts of the earth, and the fowls shall summer upon them, and all the beasts of the earth shall winter upon them. For all works of man will be as words written on water. As we crouch together in this dim cellar, speaking softly behind darkened windows, worried lest we have been infiltrated, or that listening devices or cyborg insects are nearby, or the vindictive functionaries of the Corpsey Corps may even now be speeding towards us, we have more need than ever of our resolve. We pray that the spirit of Saint Diane may inspire us and help us to stand firm in the moment of trial. Fear not, says that spirit, even if the worst shall come, for we shelter in the wings of a yet greater spirit. An hour before dawn, we must move out of this hiding place, singly and in twos or threes. Be silent, then, my friends. Be invisible. Merge with your own shadows. And with grace, we will prevail. We cannot sing for fear of being overheard, but let us whisper. Today we praise our Saint Diane.
Today we praise our Saint Diane, whose blood for bounteous life was spilled. Although she interposed her faith, one species more was killed. For all around the misty hill, track the wild guerrilla bands until they learn to trust her love and take her by the hand. Those timid giants, huge and strong, she held in her courageous arms. Guarded them with anxious care, lest they should come to harm. Too many violent hands and hearts, Diane, too sadly few like you. For when a species dies from earth, die a little too. Among the green and misty hills, where once the shy gorillas gathered, your kindly spirit wanders still in watchfulness forever.
Chapter 55. Wren. Year 25. You create your own world by your inner attitude, the gardeners used to say. And I didn't want to create the world out there, the world of the dead and dying. So I sang some old gardener hymns, especially the happy ones. Or I danced. Or I played the songs on my See Here candy, though I couldn't help thinking that now there'd be no more new music. "Say the names," Adam One would tell us, and we'd chant these lists of creatures. Diplodocus, Pterosaurus, Octopus and Brontosaurus, Trilobite, Nautilus, Ichthyosaurus, Platypus, Mastodon, Dodo, Great Auk, Komodo. I could see all the names as clear as pages. Adam 1 said that saying the names was a way of keeping those animals alive. So I said them. I said other names too. Adam 1, Nuala, Zeb, Shaki, Croge, and Oates, and Glenn. I just couldn't picture anyone so smart being dead. And Jimmy, despite what he'd done, and Amanda. I said those names over and over in order to keep them alive. Then I thought about what Mortis had whispered at the end. "Your name," he'd said. It must have been important. I counted the food I had left. 4 weeks' worth, 3 weeks, 2. I marked off the time with my eyebrow pencil. If I ate less, I could make it last longer. But if Amanda didn't come soon, I'd be dead. I couldn't really imagine it. Glenn used to say the reason you can't really imagine yourself being dead was that as soon as you say, "I'll be dead," you've said the word "I," and so you're still alive inside the sentence. And that's how people got the idea of the immortality of the soul. It was a consequence of grammar. And so was God, because as soon as there's a past tense, there has to be a past before the past, and you keep going back in time until you get to "I don't know." And that's what God is. It's what you don't know. The dark, the hidden, the underside of the visible. And all because we have grammar. And grammar would be impossible without the FOXP2 gene. So God is a brain mutation, and that gene is the same one birds need for singing. So music is built in, Glenn said. It's knitted into us. It would be very hard to amputate it because it's an essential part of us, like water. I said, "In that case, is God knitted in as well?" And he said, "Maybe so, but it hadn't done us any good." His explanation of God was a lot different from the gardener's explanation. He said, "God is a spirit" was meaningless because you couldn't measure a spirit. Also, he'd say, "Use your meat computer," when he meant "use your mind." I found that idea repulsive. I hated the idea of my head being full of meat. I kept thinking I could hear people walking around in the building, but when I scanned the rooms, I couldn't see anyone moving. At least the solar was still working. I counted the food again. 5 days left, and that was stretching it.